I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Becoming disabled, roughly one in five Americans lives with a disability, so where is our pride movement? It's the subject of an essay by Rosemarie Garland Thompson that appeared in the New York Times this summer, and we thought that was very interesting and that we would like to have her on the air, and so she is. She's a professor of English at Emory University, where her fields of study are disability studies, American literature and culture, feminist theory, and bioethics. And she has been the author of Staring, How We Look, and several other books. Her current book project is Habitable Worlds, Disability, Technology, and Eugenics. We'll be welcoming phone call. I would anticipate that you, the audience, will have a lot to say about this issue as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Rosemarie Garland Thompson, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. What a thought-provoking article. And early in the article, you say there are pride movements for people with disabilities, but they haven't gained the same sort of traction in the American consciousness. We have a much clearer collective notion of what it means to be a woman or an African-American, gay or transgender person than we do of what it means to be disabled. Why?
I think because it's not very well recognized among most Americans that disability is a social category. We tend still to think about disability as something that's wrong with us, as a medical condition, sometimes shameful, certainly often personal. Mm. We don't have a very clear understanding of the politics of disability, and we don't have a very clear understanding of ourselves if we have a disability as belonging to a group which is sometimes socially disadvantaged and sometimes the target of discrimination. So it's hard for us to imagine ourselves as disabled people in ways that feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. You talk about a friend who said to you, and probably more than one person has said this to you, "I don't think of you as disabled." You say, "I knew exactly what she meant. You didn't think of yourself as disabled until a few decades ago." So a couple questions. Why is it that you didn't think of yourself that way until two decades ago? And what do you think when people say that to you? Is that a compliment? It was meant as a compliment, I'm sure.
Certainly it's meant as a compliment. And it's a form of intimacy in some way. It's a gesture that says, "I don't think of you as different from me. I don't think of you as foreign from me. I think of you as like me." Mm-hmm. "And therefore I identify with you, and I think you identify with me." So it's a gesture of love and inclusion. But we all have multiple identities. This is what sociology and politics has taught us, that every one of us has a position in different social systems, if you will. That's how sociologists talk about it. We all have a racial status, whether we are white, black, Latino, whatever. We all have a gender status. We all have an ability status. And those multiple identities operate all together in our lives because, of course, we experience ourselves as whole people. So my identity, my own sense of self as a person with a disability, only developed when I learned about disability rights or disability identity, when I found that it was necessary to ask for accommodations and to run into barriers that made me understand that the embodiment that I have is different from other people's and that it has an effect on my relationships with other people and it has an effect on the kind of person I am in the world and how I'm understood as a citizen, as a political subject, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand that before I learned about disability politics, disability rights, and, of course, the women's rights movement and the black civil rights movement. When I began to understand about barriers and exclusion and inclusion. And that didn't come for me until I learned about the women's movement when I was a very early adolescence. So even though I've had a pretty significant physical disability my whole life, the last thing I would ever have wanted was to be understood as a person with a disability, because that felt stigmatizing. That felt like something that made me different from my friends, my family members. And so it was only when I was able to understand, really, disability pride and disability rights that made it possible for me to be able to say something like, well, yes, I am like you, but I am a person with a disability. And like Gloria Steinem said when she turned 50 and people said, you don't look 50, she said, but this is what 50 looks like. And so in some ways, what I would want to say to a gesture like that from a friend is, yes, we are alike. This is what disability looks like.
We even have a difficult time with terminology, right? And I'm wondering if you can help us with this. It's interesting that most of us, actually many of us, will experience some kind of disability. We'll move in and out of it during our lifetimes, and we're expanding what a definition of disability is. But in terms of how you are taking yourself through the world, what do you call yourself? Is there a phrase that we should be using that is better than another phrase we might use?
Well, should is key in what you're saying. There is always an attentiveness in political and social movements to what I call the cultural work of language and meaning making. And the words that we use to talk about the ways of being we all are in the world is perpetually evolving. So we can take an example, say, from the women's movement or from the black rights movement in the United States. In the 1920s, Alain Locke launched what he called the New Negro Movement. And so black pride, if you will, was associated with a term such as Negro in the 1920s. In the 1960s, we had the Black Nationalist Movement, which gave us a whole new vocabulary about race. Phrases such as black is beautiful and black and African American emerged as a new vocabulary of pride and politicization that helped us collectively tell a new story about what it meant to be of African heritage in the United States. And the women's movement, of course, did a lot of that work as well. Some of the demeaning, infantilizing, objectifying language that we had used, that was very common to refer to women, was called into question by the women's movement, and a new vocabulary that was politicized and empowered, if you will, began to come forward. And so is the case with disability. There was, in the United States, in the early part of the 20th century, the League for the Physically Handicapped, and it was an activist organization, actually. With the laws that began to be developed in the United States starting in the late 1960s as part of the disability rights movement, as part of the larger civil rights movement that changed everything in the United States, we began to define ourselves differently. The term disability and disabled stayed with us, even though it has a somewhat negative meaning.
It does, right.
In terms of its actual denotation. But the reason it stayed with it is that it was the language that was encoded in the legislation. And so I find it to be a powerful term, even though it has a negative denotation. I see it more akin to, for example, the term that is recuperated that we use now in terms of LGBTQ rights, and that is queer. So that disabled does the work of associating who we are in the world with a whole rights movement and a whole set of policies and legislation that really has redefined what it means to be a handicapped person, a disabled person, an ill person. And that vocabulary, that politicized vocabulary, I think does really important work.
Yeah, interesting. And it also, this whole idea of, and I'm wondering what it was like for you in your life, that people, we tucked people away for such a long period of time. It wasn't that long ago that we got the ACA, for heaven's sake. We didn't have accessible buildings, places, you know, to walk across the street. There, this country was so slow to coming to the realization that we have disabilities and that people need to be able to function because they're human beings and they do a lot of things and you can't tuck everybody away. I'm wondering if we have moved from a time when, and I'm wondering if you went through this in your life, you talk about this shame-filled, I was born this way, when you have to tell people what your disability is, to now I have a disability and these are the accommodations that I need.
Exactly. And that's a new way of self-presentation. And, of course, the entire civil rights movement in the United States did, and the world, but I'm going to talk specifically about the U.S., was a rights movement, but it was also, and this is very important, it was an integration movement. It was a desegregation movement. So what we had in the mid-20th century was a change that was fueled by the vocabulary, the sentiment of rights and inclusion, but it was a desegregation movement on many fronts. So there were all sorts of structural barriers, that's what we talk about, but they were literal policies, laws, practices that kept an enormous number of people out of institutional spaces, spaces mm-hmm. of power and privilege that had been occupied by a very narrow segment of the population structurally. In other words, there were what we call Jim Crow laws. There were racial laws that kept black people out of places, separate drinking fountains, separate bathrooms, this sort of thing. There were structural laws and policies and practices that kept women out of, for example, the military, mm-hmm. out of the most prestigious of the institutions of higher education, out of different professions. And there were, of course, barriers, laws that kept people with disabilities out of those places as well. It functioned somewhat differently for people with disabilities because there was a material and built environment that tended to keep people with disabilities out. For example, if you were a wheelchair user, there were places you simply could not go, things you could not be because you literally couldn't get into the room.
Right.
If you were a woman, you were kept out of certain places, but when the barriers came down, most women were able to enter into those places relatively, literally enter in relatively easily. The other difference between people with disabilities as a group and other groups that were segregated according to these various practices and policies was that people with disabilities were generally segregated through institutions. So people with disabilities were generally medicalized, that is to say, they were kept in other spaces as well as they were kept out of public spaces. So very often, let's say, people with Down syndrome would have been immediately institutionalized. That was the medical recommendation as well as the general practice when they were born into a family. And, of course, people can't thrive in asylums and in institutions, in long-term medical care facilities when they really don't need those kinds of care. So people with Down syndrome, for example, and other forms of developmental disabilities who were institutionalized didn't do very well. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense that they were kept out of the public space. They were kept out of integration with other people. And, of course, when the laws began to change about access to public education, for example, and the laws that said that everyone has a right to an equal and appropriate education that came in the 1970s, people with Down syndrome and other developmental disabilities as well as physical disabilities were literally integrated into things like school systems. But in order for that to happen, we had to, in many cases, rebuild the environment. So it wasn't a matter of simply opening the doors for everyone. It was a matter of figuring out how to redesign literal built material spaces in order to accommodate us in the places that we had been kept out of. Now, we had to do that with women, too, for example. We had to build women's rooms. We had to think about the spaces that women need in order to function as people, but as women. But it was a bit more complicated, I think, to integrate large numbers of people with disabilities who have varying needs for what an accessible built environment might be. And that's an ongoing challenge.
And tell me the challenges that you've faced, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, I was born with unusual arms, is the way I talk about it. My diagnostic category has always been a bit unclear, and I prefer that. I'm not very enthusiastic about medical labels, although some people with disabilities feel strongly about their diagnostic categories as a form of identity. But for me, I just have unusual arms. One is quite short, and I don't have very many fingers. So the advantage of that in terms of actual disability embodiment is that I was not kept out of spaces that had to be entered through stairs. In other words, I could negotiate stairs. So I could go to school in the sense that I could enter into a classroom. I could literally get in the door. The things that I needed to do at school, I could work around in general. For example, I could never use a typewriter, and I still don't keyboard with a computer, but I'm okay with a pen or a pencil. I wasn't able to do athletic kinds of things or other kinds of two-handed things as effectively as other people, but I was still able to function pretty effectively in a learning environment. And even though my mother had some difficulty getting a school to accept me, I was able to go into the school system, and that was a tremendous advantage, of course.
Mm-hmm. So your mother, you talk about other mothers with a son, I believe, or a child with dwarfism in your essay, that parents have to learn how to navigate a whole system, too, so they have to be advocates for you, and when you're very young, this is what my child needs.
Exactly, and one of the distinctive aspects of disability identity is that most of us are born into families filled either with non-disabled people or people who have different kinds of disabilities from us, and that's very often the case, say, with conditions such as small stature or the kind of body that I have, a lot of developmental disabilities. So, and Andrew Solomon has written about this, I think, quite beautifully.
Yes.
Book called Far From the Tree.
Yes.
Where he talks about what it means for someone to enter into a family in which there are not other family members that are like them. And he has a variety of different categories of otherness, if you will, within families. And that's often the case for people with disabilities. So when I was born into my family, my parents, my whole family had no experience of disability. In fact, they would not have even used that term. They had no, of course, consciousness about disability rights or disability inclusion. For one thing, it didn't really exist at that time in the United States in the public conversation. And yet, they, of course, although I think they were traumatized when I was born because they didn't expect, of course, anyone who would be formed differently from the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
They very soon, as most parents who have children with disabilities, not just adjusted, but embraced me as their own.
Of course, they loved
and,
you.
Well, of course,
yeah.
That's exactly what happens. And so they, particularly my mother, because of course at that time and still now, mothers are charged with, you know, the development and care of children, you know, had to kind of figure out how to position herself and how to be my advocate. I didn't have a lot of medicalization, a lot of medical needs, although I had some really pretty unnecessary experimental surgeries, which fairly traumatic. But I didn't have a highly medicalized condition. So we didn't engage particularly heavily with the medical system, and therefore I was kind of raised just not to be a sick person,
mm-hmm.
but I was raised as if I were, let's say, a healthy person, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense.
My mother sent me out into the world and said, you know, keep at it, and you've got to be
right.
there. And we didn't discuss it, as is often the case with stigmatized conditions. There was a kind of understanding of this is something we don't talk about
mm-hmm.
much,
mm-hmm.
but there was also an understanding of, you know, this is what you need to do. You need to be out there.
We're going to welcome phone calls from a number of people who are calling in already. Our guest this hour is Rosemarie Garland Thompson, and she wrote a piece in the New York Times that caught our attention. Becoming disabled, roughly one in five Americans lives with a disability, so where is our pride movement? She's a professor of English at Emory University, and she is the author of Staring, How We Look, and several other books. Her current work project is Habitable Worlds, Disability, Technology, and Eugenics. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, we love to read your comments there. Always, always is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go back to phone calls. Carol, go back. Let's start them for this hour. Carol in Green Bay. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi again, Kathleen, is what I should say. And hi, Rosemarie. You know,
hi, Carol.
I'm in a different place than you are, Rosemarie. I was diagnosed with MS August 9th of 2012. I was 54. And it's a very benign form. I wasn't sick. I was a heads-up doctor when I went into the ER with all-body numbness over a really warm weekend. And one thing led to another, and I got my MS diagnosis. And I didn't understand something my neuro told me all the way back then, my first neuro. He said, one of the biggest problems you're going to face, he said, is that you don't look sick. Well, I didn't get what he meant, and neither did I ask. I mean, I had gone through 37 tests or something like it in 6 weeks. But so I've been going along, and now it's everyone around me, everyone.
Carol, are you there?
Employers.
Yeah, your phone is cutting out. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, and I had a lump in my throat, so that was perfect. But anyway, it's people all around me telling me it's time. That's because I can't do the kind of work I used to do. I was a tech writer. I used to teach middle school and high school English, actually, and anyway, both my optic nerves are damaged, so I've been working as a caregiver. I deal with all kinds of people with disabilities, and I find that I have a heart for it, and I have a lot of love and compassion. But here's the thing. So now all these people are telling me I should apply for disability, and I'm practically heartbroken. And, you know, I just have this part of me that just really believes I'm not disabled, and it's because I suffer from profound fatigue. I get nervous if I have to work more than 30 hours in 1 week. I just think, oh, I just have to take better care of myself. Well, you know what? I am sick, and it's just, I'm having a real problem with this word. And I'll wind it up here. You know, a friend of mine told me recently, he said, it's just a word. It's just a word. And maybe it's because I'm worried about people stigmatizing me, even though I don't look sick. I'm sure that this kind of a jumble, I guess I'm rambling, but that's where I'm at.
Yeah, we're hearing you. Rosemarie.
Well, Carol, I certainly understand what you're saying and what you mean. And the word disability does have an enormous stigmatizing power. And also, you're bringing up a really important point, and that is our experience of what we might call disability, whether it's illness, whether it's deformity, whether it's disease, whether it's, there are a large number of other words that can describe how we are in the world. Almost none of them are positive. But the point is, it sounds like you have got to a place where we all get in life, but certainly as people who have medical conditions or disabilities, and that is where we need to have certain accommodations for us to carry out the expectations of life, whether those are the expectations of the workplace, the expectations of the social world, the expectations of ourself, the expectations of, if you will, the government and the society. And that's where I think disability and the label disabled can help us the most, even though it's a tough one to take on, because it's what we can do, it's what we can invoke to begin to start to ask, to request, to require the world to change for us so that we can flourish equally in the obligations and the privileges of citizenship that we have. And so you're in a tough place. I certainly know what you mean. And it's not a welcome label, but it's a useful label.
Thank you, Carol, for your call. Tracy in Wausau, hi.
Hi. Well, one thing related to what the presenter just said, I actually feel like people expect too much from me. I don't look sick either, necessarily, but the expectations, even from my family, are kind of high, and it can get pretty frustrating. But I'm recovering. I'm having a long-term recovery from a brain infection, and I lost half my vision and therefore my balance. So I've burned through a lot of money. I haven't been able to work for more than 2 years so far. I'm trying to transition, you know, now into part-time work. But it's difficult to get through daily life, and so it's hard to be an activist, though I would love to be for the cause and want to be, but it's so hard getting through the days that it's hard to even make the calls to tell people that, you know, there's a problem here. There's a problem in my community that there is no physical help for people like me who need help around the house. There is absolutely nothing, no organization. So it's been really difficult, and I'm concerned that the politicians currently running their campaigns on the idea that people are getting assistance like I do now don't deserve the help and are taking advantage of the taxpayers. I paid my dues. I worked hard, and I've been forced to retire because of illness. And I've been living on $1,000 to $1,500 a month because I'm only in my 50s. And so I'm really concerned with where politicians have been trying to take this.
Well, you are, of course, a disability advocate and a disability activist by virtue of being a person who understands herself as someone with a disability who requires services and accommodations for that. And so it's difficult because there are a lot of counter stories. There are a lot of prejudicial understandings, and that's a kind of awkward term. Everyone benefits from the structures of the society. Everyone gets something from our government. Everyone gets assistance in one way or another. One of the things that's difficult about those of us with disabilities is the kind of assistance we need might not be the same kind of assistance that other people need, that the majority, if you will, use. And to try to reframe the way we think about that is really important, and that's what I think the logic of disability rights and disability accommodation can give us. And there's a lot of resistance to it. But if you can try to find communities of other people who have disabilities, who have what we might call a somewhat politicized consciousness about disability, even disability pride, if you will, those are really important networks of support. Because it sounds to me like you're isolated, and that's a really tough place to be when you need to navigate the world in terms of your rights and responsibilities in new ways.
Do we have, is Tracy exposing a gap in the kind of assistance that people will need in order to go about their daily lives? You would think there would be something that would, some organization, some group that would be helpful to Tracy in making sure that what's done at home is done for her,
yes.
That she can't see everything. So
that actually seems to me to be the case. I mean, I don't know, obviously, what kinds of services exist provided either by local, state, or even national government where you live, but I would imagine that those services are available. Accessing those services can sometimes be complicated and difficult. You might be able to contact your local disability services organizations,
mm-hmm.
Or local even medical facilities, because there are often people in rehabilitation facilities who are able to give us advice about available services and put us in touch with those networks. But also online communities are very helpful as well.
Best of luck to you, Tracy. Thanks for your call. Heidi.
Yes, good luck, Tracy.
Heidi in De Pere. Hi, Heidi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having this. I'm having a hard time not crying.
Mm-hmm.
I was told I was a disabled vet in 2011. I was 31 years old. I'm 37 now. And it's hard because I'm 100% disabled. That is the only income I have to provide for me and my three children. And the reason why I'm disabled is because of PTSD, not because I was over in Afghanistan or over in Iraq. It was something very, very personal that happened while I was in the military. And it's hard when people ask me what I do for a living and I tell them that I'm a disabled vet and they start asking all these questions and I can't answer because it's so personal that half the time when they say, oh, well, Did you get wounded in Iraq? And I will sometimes say yes, just because it's easier, and not to have people look at me like I'm just feeding off of the system, because I don't work. It's hard for me to get out of my house. I have very hard, heavy social anxiety, and so it's difficult to see how people look at me, and I don't know what to tell them. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, this is a really challenging part of being a person with a disability, is trying to live with the stigma, and that's kind of the largest word, the stigma, the prejudice, that has traditionally been directed toward us. And one of those forms of discrimination, if you will, how to talk about things is always particularly difficult. And is one of the particular challenges is that I call it the interrogation. It's the interrogation that is understood as a socially acceptable kind of thing to say to us, and that is, like Kathleen mentioned, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? It's a kind of intrusion. It's a kind of privilege that people who understand themselves as not having anything wrong with them feel that they can put forward to us. And I think from experience, my own experience, and the other people I know who identify and are identified as disabled, the best thing to do is to consult online communities, consult other people, but just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to be prepared when people, whether they're people I know or whether they're strangers, start interrogating me, start trying to evaluate my worthiness, that you develop something that you're going to tell them that you feel good about, a way of talking about yourself, which may be mind your own business, or it may be this is how I am and this is what happened to me. Whatever it is that can make you feel worthy as the new person that you are since you have acquired a disability, think through what that story might be. It can be one word, or it can be paragraphs. And be ready to offer it up in however form that you feel is most empowering for you when that interrogation, that intrusive interrogation starts.
Mm-hmm. And Heidi, do you feel like you don't have resources to help you through any of this? Do you feel like you've exhausted all of the people who might be around in your area to talk to?
Well, I mean, my family is very supportive. My doctors are very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult when, you know, you meet your neighbors and they start looking at you.
Right.
Yeah.
A certain way because you're, you know, not going to work.
Right.
Your lawn may be long because you don't have somebody to come and cut your lawn for some reason, or, you know, just various
right.
different things. And it's just a language. I don't know what language to use without getting too personal, and I don't want to get too personal with some people.
Well, you know, one of the things, Heidi, to keep in mind is that the structure of the anti-discrimination legislation about disability says that, for example, your employer cannot require you to disclose your medical condition. And even though I know you're not talking about that, it's that principle of dignity that is really important. I like to tell good stories about disability, but the hardest thing for people with disabilities is to hold on to dignity. And it surely can be done. And there are lots of models out there now. Do you know who Tammy Duckworth is?
No, I do not.
Tammy Duckworth is a congresswoman from, I believe, Illinois.
Yeah, it's Illinois.
I got that right.
It's Illinois.
Okay. And she's running for she's running for Senate now, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She is a woman with a disability. She's a mother. She is a person of color. She is a double amputee and uses prosthetic legs. She's a veteran. And she is an amazing model for all of us. Not a model in terms of we ought to be doing what it is that she's doing, but we can look to her and say, okay, this is possible. Meaning this, being not being a senator, but being out there in the world as we are, making no excuses for ourselves, not having to justify our existence or our rights, but rather being out there in the world, in the public world, accessing the world the way non-disabled people do. And you know, follow her. Find other people. See if you can find some kind of community. I think that sort of thing, isolation is the hardest thing for
us. Yes, yeah.
And it sounds like you're isolated.
Thank you so much, Heidi, for your call.
Thank you.
Really heartfelt stories here. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Rosemarie Garland Thompson is a professor of English at Emory University and wrote a very, very interesting piece in the New York Times that we saved because we wanted to talk to her. Becoming disabled, roughly one in five Americans lives with a disability. So where is our pride movement? More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rather than just talk about, you know, the disabled community and the not disabled community, I want to talk about this border between us. You wrote in this piece, most Americans don't know how to be disabled. We don't get acculturated the way most of us do in race or gender. How true. Disability is fundamental to being human. The border between us and them is fragile. We just might be better off preparing for disability than fleeing from it.
Yes, and one of the most distinctive aspects of disability identity and disability experience is that most people come into this at different points and in different ways in their lives. Other social categories tend to be a bit more stable. Most of us are born as men or women, although there are, of course, instabilities in those identities and conflicts in those identities. Most of us are born into certain ethnic or racial groups, and as I mentioned, we become acculturated to those identities. But disability can come to us in a second. You know, Christopher Reeve, Superman, became quadriplegic. He went from one category of super normal to being quadriplegic in a second. Most of us will become disabled over a lifetime because we're all made out of flesh and bone and blood. And as we move through the world affects that flesh and bone and blood that we're made out of. And so we all age into or evolve into, is how I think about it, into disability. But it's an unfamiliar place to be when we get there because, as I mentioned, we don't learn how to be disabled. The stories that we tell about disability are largely very negative ones. And that's in part because we haven't had very many models of how to be a disabled person that we can look at and say, okay, I can do that. I mean, that's what someone like Tammy Duckworth presents. When Franklin Roosevelt was president in the 1930s, he hid his disability. He never used a wheelchair in public, but he used a wheelchair every day of his life. And we have Tammy Duckworth out there now. You know, this is a different time. It's a post-ADA time with those red, white, and blue stars and stripes prosthetic legs as a woman presenting herself as a politician with a disability. That was impossible in the 1930s, and it's possible now. And but those scripts are new, and it's hard to adjust to a whole new identity, one that we have understood previously as the identity that we weren't. We weren't disabled people, or we didn't understand ourselves as disabled people until something happens and our status changes. And that's an enormous transition, both psychologically and socially, as well as, you know, physically. But the psychological, emotional, and social part of it is itself very, very challenging.
Rebecca in Oconomowoc, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so. Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to add one point. I mean, I've been disabled with MS since I was 28. I'm 63 now. I'm an attorney, and I've practiced law part time, on and off, through the years, through the decades. But I've helped quite a number of disabled people attempt to achieve Social Security disability. And I just wanted to make the point that perhaps one reason why folks are not in sort of incited to speak their voice on disability issues and bring public face to that is their fear of loss of disability benefits once they've received them, because that in itself is an ongoing process by the Social Security Administration, and a lot of people depend on that income to live. And that was my point.
Rosemarie.
Exactly, and thank you for that, Rebecca, and thank you for your work. It's really important for there to be professionals who work with people with disabilities to help us be able to access the services and the rights and the, enact the responsibilities that we have as citizens. I mean, one of the things, you know this as well as anyone, that distinguishes people with disabilities from the non-disabled population is that it's harder for us to access the services that we need than it is for non-disabled people. Take, for example, driving. So driving and using the infrastructure that our taxes provide for us, bridges, roads, all sorts of the built environment around driving is a privilege, and it's a service that people who drive, and many disabled people don't drive, but for people who are drivers, they are able to access those services without really doing much of anything. There's a real smooth access path for many non-disabled people to get the services that that our society provides. Sometimes it's harder to do that as people with disabilities because the kinds of services that we need are often different from the kinds of services that are widely available and easily accessible to non-disabled people. And so that's a particular challenge, and the infrastructure of assistance in accessing services is really important in our social structure. So thank you for your work.
Thanks, Rebecca. Time for one more call, probably. Jeremy in Racine. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think one of the things that people need to understand, education is the key for things to move forward for people with disabilities. And for that young lady that served in the service and has 100% disability, I understand where she's coming from. 8 years military myself, Operation Iraqi Freedom Vet. Regardless of what it is you do in the military, whether it's during peacetime or wartime, it is a very demanding job, and things happen. And you don't have to walk around explaining to people what happened to you. That young lady needs to keep her chin up, and I like to say thank you for standing on that wall, and don't worry about what other people are thinking, and just move on with your life with it. Because I know a lot of vets that deal with the same thing. And my best advice is I always tell them, come on down with me to the VFW. There's a lot of veterans that go through the same thing, and it's a brotherhood. So that's it.
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah.
Thank you for your contribution. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that sense of community, you can't beat it. Well, thank you so much for being with us. A lot of response, Rosemarie, and thanks for your wise and tender words to so many callers. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kathleen Dunn. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
Happy to have you here. Rosemarie Garland Thompson, she's a professor of English at Emory University. We'll post her essay on our Facebook page, so in case you haven't read the whole thing, it's worth your eyes and attention. Becoming disabled. Roughly 1 in 5 Americans lives with a disability. So where is our pride movement? Thanks so much to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP for doing the on-air production here in Milwaukee. We're again with you tomorrow. Just a reminder that Daniel Golden and Ann Patchett will both be with us with book recommendations from both of them. You'll have your reading material for the rest of the year, well, and into next year, without a doubt. So that's tomorrow during our 2 o'clock hour. Thanks so much for listening and for participating in the program. News is coming up in just a little while here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.